your caliber. And I've noted many of the comments that you've made for inclusion into the bill. And I'll be speaking with the bill sponsor to see what his reaction is, if there is any, and whether or not there's been any communication between you on these particular issues that you've mentioned. Are there questions for Mr. Callahan? Seeing none, thank you again, sir, and I apologize for keeping you on the line back east for so long. I hope the discussion has been noteworthy.
Oh, it's been very interesting, and let me get to anything else I can do as a way to help.
You bet. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
At this time, it is the intent of the chair to take the table this issue until 4:30, at which point we will return after the Labor and Commerce Committee completes its work. But before we recess for an hour, I would like to take up House Bill 190, Viatical Settlements. There is an individual in Anchorage that has been standing by. Mr. Lohr, are you still there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
And you've received a copy of the committee substitute with the proposed new language as per discussed in the committee on Monday?
That's correct. I have the new CF okay. Work draft.
Thank you. Then I'd like to take up House Bill 190, Representative Roekberg.
Mr. Chairman, I move CF to House Bill 190, Judiciary 1LS0576/N-2100.
There is a motion to adopt the committee substitute. Is there objection? Representative Green.
Object only for the fact that the rewrite has been looked at by both groups, especially the page 5.
I'll explain the change.
Yeah, I know what the changes are, but you're moving the bill now, and I'm wondering if the rewrite.
We're just moving to adopt it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Excuse me, I wasn't paying attention.
So we can at least get into the discussion.
Yes, I'm sorry. Pardon me.
If seeing no objection, then we do have the CS before us, and please all of you would just briefly explain what kind of damage control we've accomplished. And there's two changes on page 2 and page 5.
Yeah, members of the committee. What we had the drafters do is insert changes to reflect some of the concerns that members had last time. The two concerns, the first was the degree of privacy that would be afforded the viator and the insured, as well as a viator or an investor. And so if you'll notice, the first change on page 2, lines 16 through 20, is reflective of that privacy concern. And that governs privacy between the insured and the viator and the insurance company. Also note that we added a sentence at the end enabling the viator to waive this prohibition against disclosure if it's in writing and signed. The next change is page 5. Lines 21 through 16 is the exact same language. The only difference is that it governs privacy as between the viator and the Department of Community and Economic Development and as well as the investor. Same waiver language is there. And up above it, lines 12 through 20, is a concern that Representative Kurtula actually had with respect to buyer information. And that that clause is the same language that was in the original HB 190 and has simply been re-included into this bill, the substitute.
Okay.
Questions about the language?
Explains the language that's been inserted. Representative Roekberg.
Mr. Chairman, I've been in discussions with both divisions, and there's two minor technical amendments that they wish to make. And if you'd like me to move amendment, conceptual amendment number one.
Let's deal with them individually, starting with number one.
Right. Mr. Chairman, I move conceptual amendment number one as to page 2, line 18, deleting the word name and substituting identity. And also on page 5, line 23, same thing, removing the word name and substituting an identity. And I'd like Ms. Campbell from the Division of Insurance to comment on that just very briefly. Because
okay.
The
Ms. Campbell.
The department's requested this amendment.
Hi, I'm Katie Campbell with the Division of Insurance. I just noticed this was a discussion that took place at the NAIC, and the concern is that you could give out other information, such as their address, that would lead to identifying the individual. So it's not just giving out the name
per se. Mm-hmm.
So this takes care of anything that could identify that person.
Okay. Mr. Lohr, did you hear the amendment?
Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Chair.
You're in agreement?
No problem with that. It's broader.
Okay. Is your objection, Representative Green?
No objection.
No objection. Without objection, then amendment number one has been adopted. Representative Roakberg.
Chairman, I'd like to move conceptual amendment number two, page 5. Lines 17 through 21, after the word includes, I'd like to delete all language after that on line 17, 18, 19, and 20, and substitute the following language.
We're on page five. After the word includes on line 17.
17, and delete the issuer's most recent audited income and expense statement and balance sheet. A statement of risk and disclosure, any significant negative factor may affect the outcome of the investment. That's on 17, 18, 19, and 20. Delete that and substitute include state mandated disclosure form. And if Mr. Usera would briefly comment on that for the record, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Usera.
Yes. For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Vince Usera, Department of Community and Economic Development. In our discussions, when we were dealing with our regulations, we discussed all provisions with the Viatical Association of America. They registered strong disapproval of giving out an audited income and expense and balance statement to the investor. Now, our regulations provide they must give that to us, to the division, in order to prove that they are going concern and that they have the wherewithal to meet their obligations. But for one, I don't think most investors really know how to read the statement properly. And second, the Viatical Association objected strongly that that's going too far into removing their level of privacy, too.
Okay. Anybody understand the rationale? Representative Murkowski.
Thank you. Yes, I understand the rationale, but explain to me exactly what is required then by the division.
We require them to give to us proof that they've been in business 3 years, audited income and expense statements for the most recent year. I can't remember off the top of my head, but we require quite a bit of information. And we're going to look out for the investor in that respect. If they're a going concern, they'll get the exemption. They can go sell their product. But I don't think giving it to the investor is going to necessarily save the investor at any heartache. If the investor understands it, if he takes the time to read it, and those are questionable. He's not going to get that much out of it.
Mr. Chair, one of the provisions that I kind of liked in here that you're suggesting that we delete is disclosure of any significant mm-hmm. negative factor that may affect the outcome.
We require that.
Okay, you're still requiring that. Would there be any way to let the investor know? And the investor knows that you have all this stuff on file with insurance, so they're a bona fide entity. Mm-hmm. But if I, as an investor, come to the division and say, I'm inquiring about this company, would you tell me, by the way, in addition to all the things that they've complied with, there's a few black marks on their record?
If there were a few black marks on their record, it's not likely we would give them the exemption. We would allow them to sell here, depending on the type of black mark. It may be a black mark that they've overcome. It's sort of a judgment call on some of that. We will do our job in protecting the investor. And if that requires disclosure of certain information about the company, I believe we would disclose it.
I guess I'm just a little hung up with the fact that you all have that information, but there may be a wall with the investor having any access to it. I don't know how much we should make available. I recognize the concern mm-hmm. that's out here. I don't know if we're there yet.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Roper.
The structure would be such that includes, that information would include the state mandated disclosure form, but it doesn't exclude them giving other information which could be handled by regulation. That's the idea, because it includes but not
it's
limited
included.
To
mm-hmm.
is our way our statute drafting manual. Because the other way is, I thought that this was improved because it gives the department a little more flexibility in perhaps under the right circumstances, give more information than was stipulated right here in statute. That's why I took their recommendation as a positive.
Representative Murkowski, if I may, all our files except for investigation files, all our files are public records. So if we know of something about the company that is negative, we can and will tell them. If you wanted to mandate that we already provide the statement of risk, but disclosure of any significant negative factor may still be in the bill. That doesn't have to be out. We kept the word includes in order to leave it flexible enough to allow other items. The main choking point, if you will, is audited income and expense statements.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Green.
Thank you. Well, if I hear you, then if we were to not exclude all that, but starting on page 18, line 18, after disclosure form, and then reinsert, and a disclosure of any significant negative factor, would that pass muster?
That would be fine with us.
I think I would join with Representative Murkowski. That kind of gives me a little bit better feel. That
it makes you feel good and tickles me to death, sir. Okay. Representative Murkowski.
As long as we're still looking at that language that's in there, when I first read it, disclosure of any significant negative factor, if there's two factors, you may be excluding it. I think we just need to say factors.
Yes,
I think you're correct.
Mr. Chairman, I take that as a friendly amendment.
Friendly amendment to the amendment.
And I just say that if I could restate the amendment then, or is there, I'd move that as a amendment to the amendment. Mr. Chairman, I'd move the amendment to the amendment.
That was the amendment to the amendment.
He's moving.
There was no objection to the amendment to the amendment. So the amendment is as amended. For us.
Right, which would say
you're going to restate that, I think I've captured it.
Include the state mandated disclosure form or forms?
Forms, plural.
Plural. Okay.
In fact,
and a disclosure of any significant negative factors that may affect the outcome of the
investment. The word negative is not included. We're not going to include the word negative, just any factor, significant factor.
Okay, factors.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask a question relating to the amendment?
As amended?
As amended.
Yes.
Just through the chair, do we have any definition of what a significant factor is?
That's it.
I think I know what it is.
Sorry.
I mean, I think negative limits it to some degree, because it could be a positive factor, something, or a neutral factor that does significantly affect the outcome of the investment. For instance, if the insured has a life expectancy of 15 years, that's neither a good nor bad factor as regards, but it may positively affect the outcome of the investment, because it could be could run it down to a virtual loss, if you will. Representative Cotullo, are you comfortable with that, or?
I'm still a little concerned about it. I mean, I trust Mr. Usera, but he's not always going to be there, and I just think it's a lot of latitude. I'm glad we're including more language, but I'm a little concerned still. What about the statement of risks? I mean, is that something that the companies, through the chair, objected to as well?
No, they did not object to our disclosure form. Our disclosure form is taken, for the most part, from the state of Maine. I beefed it up a little bit. We went with something that's tried and true. They gave us their form, and we used that as the basis for our disclosure form. I put a few more factors in there that have to be considered.
Mr. Rubberg?
Mr. I'd just say that to Representative Cartula, I think it's the reason we don't need it there, it would be redundant, in my opinion. That's all.
But, yeah, I don't want to be redundant through the chair. I'm just worried about what happens with the latitude with the state form. Because if we just say state form, that could change in future years.
And
that's what I'm worrying about. So I'm just wondering it would maybe be making me a little more comfortable to include the things that we could that the association didn't agree with. So maybe the balance sheet, the statement of risks, and the disclosure of any significant factors.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, as much as we can say, I think the better off we are, because Mr. Usera, who again I do trust, isn't always going to be there.
Right. We wanted, at least in the early part, we wanted the latitude to change the disclosure form at will, because we may find we're interested in protecting the public. If we find something that the public should know about, we'll incorporate that in our form, and we can do it overnight. If it's in statute, we're hamstrung. It may be something you want to revisit from a legislative standpoint, perhaps in another couple of years when this activity either becomes stabilized or doesn't rear its ugly head, one or the other, but you have further information to go on.
I'll get off this in 1 second, but wouldn't you always, would you really have any problem including the balance sheet and statement of risks?
They have, the balance sheet, the economic, the financial factors, the income and expense and the balance sheet, they're going to give that to us, and it will be there in our files and disclosable to any investor who says, I want to see their balance sheet, we'll give it to them. But I don't think we want to require that be given as a matter of course. It's more paper. It's kind of, frankly, the disclosure forms, we tried to keep them short because the more you disclose, the less effect you have. I mean, there comes a point of diminishing returns because the disclosures are so voluminous that nobody reads them.
Yeah.
But you're saying that they are available.
They are available. If the person wants to see, if somebody understands how to read a balance sheet and calls us and says he wants it, he'll get it.
And you're going to make sure that the public understands that?
Yes. Have you ever visited our website?
No, just you.
Representative Croft, you're too quiet over there.
Sorry.
Okay.
Can you say
something, Mr. Is there objection to the amendment, then, as we have it before us amended?
Yes.
I love the amendment.
Seeing none, then the amendment number 2 is adopted. Are there further amendments? None. Good.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move my own bill.
Representative Roquefort, I would expect you to do that. If nobody else will, I mean.
Mr. Chairman, I move committee substitute for House Bill 190 Judiciary as amended.
By Roquefort.
With individual recommendations with zero fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Seeing none, then the bill is moved.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Braben, are you still on the line?
No, sir.
He had to go. Okay. Then it is the intent at this time to recess for a period of 1 hour, at which point we'll reconvene. And if there's anyone else that is out of town on House Bill 253, we'll take those. Looks like there may have been a couple, one or two, and then we'll move into Senate Bill 24. But we will do a time certain of 5:30 because I know there's additional commitments this evening.
Well put.
So we're recessing for 4:30. Okay, we'll call the Judiciary Committee back to order at 4:45 for the record. We do have a quorum. Representative Croft, Tula Green, and myself. I want to continue the hearing on House Bill 253 for the purpose of dispensing with one person on the teleconference line who's been there in Fairbanks.
Wow.
And if there are any members of the public here in Juneau that will not be able to make the next hearing, or if you've flown in from out of city here from another location, then I would take you, but otherwise we will continue this hearing early next week, probably Monday, and we'll move into Senate Bill 24. So without further ado, Mr. John Rigatano from Fairbanks, you on?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
We can. Please state your name, affiliation for the record.
Yeah, John Rigatano. I'm with Family Centered Services of Alaska. I'm Director of Planning. Our agency is a nonprofit that works almost exclusively with children that have mental health disabilities under the age of 18 and their families. Thanks for the opportunity to speak. I'll try and keep it brief and hope you ask questions if it's unclear on my comments or if you'd like me to expound on. There's four main concerns with the bill in its present state. First off, we'd like to say that we're very concerned with safety in the schools, and we work a lot with
school districts throughout the state, in particular Fairbanks and Delta Junction area, to help prevent, be preventive and do intervention to never get to a violent situation. If in fact the bill were just to say that we were, that all school districts are required to have a plan in place, we wouldn't have any concern with that. We think that's a good measure to have in place. And that brings up the first point, which is currently, I believe the majority of the students, Alaska children, they attend public schools, now are covered by school disciplinary plans. And I think those plans are working very well. Of course, nothing's perfect, but by and large, my understanding is they work well, and they are developed by local communities and applied fairly and overseen by the appropriate boards and administration. So I think that we really have most of them covered at this point. The other, second point that's a major concern is that there's no wording whatsoever into this legislation, proposed legislation, that addresses children with disabilities and federal laws that apply to them. And the IDEA law is one. There's the 504 plan and IEPs. Fairbanks School District alone has 2,300 children that are on 504 or IEP plans. And that's an important point because any children under those federal laws, they have federal rights really for their disabilities. And disciplinary procedure against them needs to be well thought out, whatever the policy is in that district. It needs to be included in any plans developed by any school district. So wording to that effect, compliance with all applicable federal laws needs to be included in there somewhere as a safeguard, clearly, so that that can be brought into the thought process when these plans are developed. And there can be input by appropriate people with that knowledge, social service workers, special ed teachers in the district, special ed departments, and parents of those children. The third point is the reasonable force, use of appropriate reasonable force is applied to two issues here. One issue I think is very appropriate. There's a comfort level with it. It's regarding safety. I don't think there's any argument that in a situation where the safety of students, faculty is a concern, that use of appropriate force is needed. But the other point that use of appropriate force is now being applied to in the wording of the bill as it now stands is with discipline. So force and discipline now are linked together, and force can be used for discipline. And as was stated earlier by the lady from the Anchorage School District, that's very subjective, especially in a school setting. You can't detail all these things out that may occur. But if you have wording that says force can be used for discipline, discipline is really in the eye of the beholder. And, you know, if it's used inappropriately, a case can always be made that it was somehow linked to safety. So safety by itself, again, is fine, but when we've got discipline in the bill, it really doesn't work. Our agency doesn't have comfort with it. Yeah, and then the last point is that, and that was spoken, I think, pretty well again by the Anchorage person from the Anchorage School District. It's very subjective here. You know, it's very hard to define all things that could possibly occur in the school setting that would require appropriate force, reasonable force. In fact, it's really impossible. I think we all know that. Best efforts that everybody made could get hopefully the majority of them, but certainly not all of them. So those are the concerns that we have with it. Again, we like the discussion on school safety and violence, but in its present form, we really are very adamantly opposed to the bill. Those are my comments. If you have any questions, I wasn't speaking clear, please feel free to ask.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? We have no questions here. Thank you very much for your noted concerns.
And thank you for taking me there.
Is there anyone else on the teleconference line that wishes to testify on House Bill 253? Hearing none, is there anyone here in the audience that has a time constraint? Out of town? Okay. Then we will close the public testimony on 253 at this time and reopen it at our next hearing.
Excuse me, Chairman. When would you anticipate that will be?
Monday. Again, the next hearing on House Bill 253 will be on Monday. The next turn to Senate Bill 24. The sponsor of the bill is here. This bill was scheduled earlier. It was postponed. I think there was still some additional work being formalized on the matter. And we've got the new CS before us for the purpose of discussion. Make the motion myself to adopt it, but I know Representative James will.
Move the CS, is it P?
P.
P, CS, put it before us as a working document.
Is your objection? Seeing none, we have version P, dated 126 double aught from Bannister, before us. Senator Donnelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for scheduling Senate Bill 24. Just to refresh the committee's memory, the committee had seen this legislation towards the end of last year, and we asked for the time to continue to work with industry over the interim and develop a CS for the legislation that you've just adopted. It's the product of a series of meetings over many, many months with the many sectors of the natural resource development industry and the State Chamber of Commerce, and I think we've brought you back a very good product here. The new CS is narrowed in focus, and now it only applies to the Department of Environmental Conservation. What we've really tried to do here is take all the things we've heard for years from the public about how regulations are too difficult and too onerous, and to work with industry to try to figure out what we can actually do. And one of the things we're concerned with is as you make these changes, they cause changes in the status quo. So we're trying to take just DEC as a pilot program here, an experiment, so that if something doesn't work well, we haven't changed the entire system. But if something does work well, then later on we can come back and adopt it and apply it to other sectors of state government. So we focused in on just DEC in the committee substitute. And we set out new standards that we've worked out with the industry for what a regulation has to meet before it should be adopted. And we've adopted additional procedural requirements before adopting regulations, which include mailing notices to people who have offered comments that a regulation is going to be changed, the proposed regulation, publishing information on the internet. Industry must report its intent to promulgate regulations within a fixed period of time. As you know, we've had some bills that we've passed here where they required regulations to be adopted, but the regulations weren't adopted for, I think, one example, up to 5 or 6 years. This would give the departments of this DEC a fixed period of time to say yes or no, we intend to adopt regulations or not. If they move ahead with regulations, the bill gives them a 2-year time window to do the regulations. Now, we've tried to carefully craft this so that if something goes wrong and they don't get it done in 2 years, it doesn't mean they can't. But we've put incentives and encouragement for them to get it done in 2 years in the legislation, such as at the 18-month period, if they haven't done it already, they're supposed to provide a report to the legislature saying why they haven't done it and whether, you know, what's the problem, what they intend to do, whether they're going to make their goal. So we've tried to build incentives in without preventing the thing from happening in the end. And we've also built things in to keep it from being the subject of any litigation and things like that, which would also slow down the process. So the intent that we've worked out here is a system by which we encourage the departments to get the administration's the regulations that are necessary adopted, and if they don't do it, at least we'll get information why they haven't done it, and they'll have to justify in writing why they haven't done it. So that's a big feature that industry really likes. And also, of course, the bill still contains the requirement of supplemental notices to the public if the original intent of a regulation changes dramatically and what they intend to adopt. You know, we go through this committee process, Mr. Chairman, where every committee substitute's published. It's available at every step along through the committee process. But in the regulatory process today, unless they deem that there's a major change in some way, public gets one notice and then the thing comes out and it has the force of law. With this, if there's a substantial change in what they originally published their notice to the public of, they have to go back out and give supplemental notice and warn the public, well, now we're going to do something different than we originally, because there may be people out there that need to know that, Mr. Chairman. So we think Senate Bill, this particular CS, is a really good step. It's a pilot program, and earlier today, we had folks from the Alaska Miners Association here in support of it by teleconference, also from Alaska Forest Association. Sea Alaska, I believe, has submitted written testimony in support of it, and they were here present earlier today also. And Pam LeBeau with the State Chamber is still here. And I also have Hans Nadig of my staff to walk you through section by section if that's your desire, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Donnelly. Are there questions for the sponsor? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, I applaud the whole concept. There is one question I have on page 5, and I think I know why it's here, but I'm afraid of it, if I can make that statement. It's line 9 through 10. You have allowed, in addition to the fact that there are these other things that would possibly be a preventative from doing it in 2 years, that the agency has made good faith effort to adopt the regulations within a 2-year period. Won't they always say they have made a good faith effort? And isn't this still a license to steal? It just seems to me that an agency, if they want to adopt regs, 2 years is much more time than needed. If they don't, they're going to make some effort to say that they've... we should have been working at it. And I'm just wondering if that's really a necessary part of the bill. I think it undoes all the good you're trying to do.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Donnelly.
Mr. Chairman, I remember how this came to be, I think, from the many meetings we had this summer, was the case was raised where, what if there's some good reason while, you know, we're waiting for something from a court or we're waiting for something else from the federal government and we just have a good faith reason why we got it. It might make sense to wait a little bit longer. There's some settlement that's taking place in the judicial process. But I agree with you. It probably is too broad. And considering there's no particular penalty for not doing it other than you need to submit a report to the legislature saying you failed to do it and why, because we didn't want to set it up for a bunch of frivolous litigation to block necessary economic development regulations, right, is why we set it up that way. I would defer to the committee's judgment and to the judgment of the folks from industry about whether or not that should remain.
Okay. And Pam's going to testify. Okay.
Representative James.
Yeah, I guess, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, I was just, in the fact that there is no penalty for this, what kind of, is there a political penalty for this if they don't get it done? Is that what it is? Or is there a legislative penalty? I mean, I suppose if they don't do it, what if they refuse to do it? Then what do we do? I mean, I think there has been cases where they have refused to do regulations for various reasons. And then I guess to just follow up if I'm not on that question, because what this does is require them to re-notice, which is one of the biggest flaws they had in their regulation noticing process, too. You know, you've got 30 days to respond to this, and we have these options. We can do nothing, or we can make changes, or we can just implement it like it is. I mean, what are you telling the people? We don't hear from you, really, because what you say isn't going to make any difference anyway. But what you're saying is if there is any changes and then they react to those changes, they have to notice it again. If they're not very cooperative in the beginning of this process, it could take them a long time to get that done, from my experience of past regulation writing. So I think this will persuade them that they have a two-year time frame, of which there might be some legislative retaliation if they don't, that might make them move a little faster.
The chair. First of all, I like it because it gives them a goal. And, you know, I mean, there's folks over there, and I believe they take the statute seriously, that when we give them specific goals, they try to make them. We do it in a reasonable way, though. I think 2 years is a reasonable period, and but there are, I think, legitimate times where maybe it can't be done in 2 years for good reasons, and we talked about those this summer a lot. So there's a report, and you know they're going to hate doing that report. You know, when the 18 months comes and they haven't done it, they're not going to be happy about admitting they haven't done it and putting down on paper why. I mean, that's not going to be a popular thing with the bureaucracy. So I think it's a really reasonable, measured first step, you know, as an experiment to see if it might work, right, to build a little more incentive into the process to have them get it done in 2 years. I agree, if there's bad faith on the part of bureaucracy, they can get away with an awful lot. And you know how that works. Unless somebody sues them, they win, right? You know. So I think, though, these are all positive, measured, reasonable steps that are worthy of trying as an experiment with a single department.
I agree. Senator Tula.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. First, why pick DEC? Why was DEC chosen as the agency to have this happen to?
Mr. Chairman? Well, the history of the bill is it started as a general provision, and then it was actually a suggestion of the administration that we pick one department and focus in on that one department and do it as a pilot program. In the Senate, there was DNR, DEC, Habitat Division, and one other subsistence? What other section of fish and game? But to try to get fiscal costs down, try to address, you know, just the specifics, because there's pretty unique concerns with each department you work with. Actually, as you go through, you find that the public has specific concerns about the different elements of it. We finally narrowed it down just to DEC is one we'd just like to give it a try with. So the original suggestion actually came from the administration, although they didn't suggest DEC specifically, but through the committee process, that's what it's come down to.
Okay, and second, I have real concerns in the section that talks about invalidating the regulation. It's on page 2, and it's, I think, it's section 3 of the bill. And I guess I'm not understanding how this is going to work. Is it that a person, if they find or they think that the regulation isn't valid or effective, that they go to court, or do they contact the agency? And then we've got changing burdens of proof, and maybe you can explain how that's going to work, because I think that's real complicated, and I just haven't ever seen anything like that for a regulatory process before.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, this whole section was developed, like we say, with the many meetings we've had over the summer trying to come up with a system we thought would work that would prevent frivolous lawsuits that would just tie up the regulatory process so that industry couldn't proceed with needed regulations. But at the same time, if a regulation really wasn't the intent of a statute, that there'd be a specific standard of how a court would examine that and overturn it. We've placed the burden of proof on the person challenging the regulation so that it would be a clear test. We've tried to really specify what the tests are so it's not ambiguous and it's not uncertain here. And these were the things that our working group came up with specifically. I think it's, like I say, it's an experiment. It's a try. A person would, if the department didn't respond and agree and modify, you know, obviously could write them a letter and say, we think this is out of line and you're not complying with the intent of the statute. And the department could either reach a compromise with those people or force people to go to court. If they did go to the court, it would be their burden that the regulation was invalid under that section. But the section also serves, I think, a purpose of it. It's a clear statement. It's a statement that this is how the legislature wants its statutes interpreted. It also gives more, I think, clearer guidance to the executive branch in interpreting the statutes, and I think that's very useful.
If I could just ask one follow-up question.
Hans, did you want to comment on that?
I could run through those sections a little bit of the evolution if that was the will of the committee.
Maybe I could just ask my question. I don't know if anybody else would like it. Just maybe get the explanation on this. What would happen, because they're mutually exclusive sections here in 1A and B under Section 3, what happens if you have a statute that requires a regulation, but it does impose a material capital or operating cost, and, there isn't any significant public benefit? I mean, it's a particular statute. It applies to a particular industry. You really couldn't show a significant public benefit across the board. And you've got an or in here. Wouldn't you run the risk of having somebody being able to bring a suit against that regulation?
There's a specific exception when it's required by a statute.
Okay, I guess I'm worrying and not reading it that way.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Hans Medig, staff to Senator Donnelly. That section, actually, that test and that language right there comes from the Alaska Forestry Act. And that already exists, or there's language similar to it that exists. So it's not setting up necessarily a new standard, anything that's outside of the ordinary. But that language, the test established in 1B of Section 3, is in response to widely held perception generally that regulations and their associated costs of compliance often end up impacting private persons and our industry while not providing public benefits, i.e. the cost of the proposed regulation actually outweigh the benefits. Now, consequently, it made sense to provide a burden of proof for a person challenging the regulation using the test provided in 1B to prove that their case by proving that a preponderance of evidence exists in their favor. It's my understanding that this is the existing standard used in most civil cases already, providing for a preponderance of evidence.
If I might just ask another question, and I'll check the Forestry Act. Thanks for pointing that out. But is it significant public benefits in the Forestry Act, or is it just public benefits? That's the one concern I've got. If it says significant versus public benefit, thanks.
And the answer to your other question, Representative Grutula, through the chair, is that the existing law in Section 2 of the bill says when it's something's reasonably necessary to carry out the purpose of the statute, that's what they do. And so we've tried to maintain the specific provision that obviously if the statute says you shall adopt regulations that do such and such, they're covered. I mean, that's what they got to do.
I guess I still have a concern, but thank you.
Further questions?
Hans, why don't you briefly just walk us through the sections and see if we can untangle some of this. Get to the right place. And while we're waiting on that, Senator Donnelly, I've probably got two questions. Number one, we're in receipt of Alaska Miner Association letter of support, and they have asked for an amendment that would deal with the effectiveness of the agency in posting regulations, see whether or not they've been effective, what they've achieved, what they were supposed to achieve. Have you reviewed that proposed language?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we just got this letter. We've been working with the miners over the summer, and they've been very helpful and given us some really good suggestions. This one's a new one. My only concern with this is the possible fiscal impact of it. I'm wondering if this might be a good thing to discuss in a finance committee, but I'm open to it. The only thing is anytime you ask them to do another report, I'm sure we're going to get a fiscal note for it.
I personally would think the fiscal application would be negligible, but that I'm not the one that's providing that written summary to the either the sponsor or the legislative committee having jurisdiction over it, but I would think it'd be negligible. But
I'm all for it if it's negligible.
Well, Representative James have yeah. been having been
if,
on that
if
particular.
If I might, I'm not convinced that that is necessarily true. I think in this bill we're only dealing with DEC. I think it might work, but I know if you count the notices that I get in my mailbox for changes in regulation, it's a huge amount of those, and so there would be some fiscal impact making another report. Not that I disagree with the need for it, because I think that, but what it requires, and let's just cut to the chase. What that would require to do would be having immense cooperation between the agency and the legislature. Doesn't exist now. Don't think it's a natural existence, and not convinced that it wouldn't be resisted and cost a lot of money.
The second question I have, Dave, for you is that in my recollection, when we have done pilot programs, and that's what you're suggesting this is, generally there's a repealer in it. So either the program is repealed after a certain time, and if it's effective, you reestablish it. Otherwise, if it's not effective, then it just goes away. We don't have to take action. How long would you foresee this having to be enacted before we can determine the effectiveness of the program? If it's working, if it works, let's expand it.
Mr. Chairman, I would think at least 4 to 5 years. It's going to take a while for the bureaucracy to adjust. It's going to take a while for private industry to adjust. I'd want to give it at least that long to have a sense of, you know, whether how it's functioning, and you know, before it just disappeared. If there was a sunset, if you're suggesting a sort of some sort of sunset provision, I actually think I'm pretty excited about this. I mean, this is a real good work product, I think. There's a lot of good stuff in here that we've talked about for years. You know, over the summer, we struggled with the idea of the cost-benefit analysis. And it was folks in the industry that for years had been asking for cost-benefit finally came to the conclusion it's just too costly and too difficult to do. You know, it actually might hamstring some things that they wanted to accomplish in regulations. And so you don't find that in here. So I think we've got a really good step here. And I think we're going to find in 2 or 3 years that we may want to expand it, actually. But I think I'd give it at least 4 or 5 years to try out.
Additional questions for the sponsor? If none, then we'll move on to public testimony. We do have Chris Kennedy from Anchorage down the line.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm here to testify for the Department of Law. I should say preliminarily that I know my usual client, Department of Environmental Conservation, would like to testify about Senate Bill 24, but Janet Adair was unable to get out of an evening commitment to be available for this rescheduled time, and I should ask on her behalf that she be given an opportunity to comment briefly at a later time. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Senator Donnelly was kind enough to share with my office the text of the new committee substitute for SB 24 a few days ago. While the bill has improved over previous versions, we continue to have a number of concerns. First of all, a housekeeping point. As I think Senator Donnelly covered, SB 24, as it's revised, applies special procedures only to DEC. Now, special administrative procedures applicable only to a single department are normally placed in the statutory title for that agency. And currently, we already have on the book some special departures from the Administrative Procedures Act that apply only to DEC, and those are in Title 46. The main example is AS 4635090. Now that it's been narrowed to relate only to DEC, the main provisions of this bill in Sections 3 and 4 should be revised to go into Title 46 rather than Title 44. I heard the discussion of this being a pilot program that might last 5 years or so. Of course, if we're a successful pilot program and someone wanted to expand it 5 years from now, one could recodify again, but 5 years is a long time to have a statute stuck up in another title where people might miss it. Now I'll turn to the substance of the bill. I'd like to look first at the standard of review, which has just been discussed and found in Section 3 of the bill. It completely replaces the current standard under which an agency's regulations are tested. And the current standard in 4462.030 is quite a firm standard. It says that regulations have to be consistent with the statutes and that they have to be reasonably necessary to carry out the purposes of the authorizing statute. This standard has been in place since 1959. It stood the test of time. The courts have decided dozens of cases based on it, and the legal community of both industry and government knows what it means. The new standard in SB 24 is entirely novel. It uses words like works and circumvents that are new to the Alaska statutes and not found in many other state statutes either. No one can predict how a court would interpret them. The SB 24 standard also inserts courts into a process of weighing costs and benefits. And here I'm talking about Part B of the new standard of review, which is at lines 8 through 10 on page 2. Under SB 24, a court cannot uphold a regulation without finding that it yields, quote, significant public benefits to counterbalance any, quote, material costs imposed on development activities. This gets the Superior Courts into weighing what is a benefit, what is a significant benefit, and what is a public benefit. Increasingly, unfortunately, courts in Alaska are coming to the realization that they are not equipped for that kind of role. The Alaska Supreme Court said in the recent Cossio case that it doesn't want to, I think the word is admired in questions of public policy as the regulations, because that is beyond our authority and expertise. I'll give you an example of the kind of weighing that would be involved. DEC issues special regulations to provide particular industrial facilities with mixing zones that, as a practical matter, allow the industry to discharge more waste into the water than federal or state law would otherwise permit. And a user of the water body, such as an ecotourism company, might challenge a regulation like that, alleging that it imposed costs on them because they have to travel farther to find a pristine tourist destination. Against that cost, the court would have to weigh the benefit of letting the industrial facility use the mixing zone. Then you would have the question of whether that is a public benefit or just a private benefit to the company that owns the facility. And some judges might even question whether it's a benefit at all. No one knows how a court would rule given this kind of language, and it introduces an uncertainty into the whole process and makes it hard for industry or anyone to know which regulations they can rely on and which are going to be snatched out from under them in some later litigation. There's another very troubling aspect of introducing a whole new standard for reviewing regulations. And to appreciate it, you have to look at Section 3 in conjunction with Section 5 on applicability. As it must to avoid a host of other problems, this bill has been framed not to be retroactive. It applies to new regulatory actions begun after July 1st of this year. The trouble comes because most of what DEC does with regulations is amend existing regulations in order to make them clearer or to respond to problems pointed out by the regulated community or to respond to changing conditions or amendments to statutes. An amendment may only change, for example, the last three words of a sentence under one sentence and of a sentence of a regulation. Later, if that regulation is challenged, then you would be testing those three words under one standard of review and the other words of the regulation under another standard of review. And within a few years, the old standard and some covered by the new test. It would be very hard to predict how a court would unravel that. While I'm on the subject of applicability in Section 5, I want to just talk for a moment about subsection A of the applicability provision. That section makes some provisions of the bill only apply to regulations if the statute giving authority for those regulations has an effective date after July 1st of 2000. The problem there is that many regulations draw authority from a combination of statutes that all have different effective dates. Also, do you go by the effective date of the first version of the statute, or do you go by the effective date of the most recent amendment of the statute, or do you engage in some sort of court inquiry into how significant the latest statutory amendment was? I think both the agency and the courts and industry would have a very difficult time knowing how to interpret this applicability provision. Let me just turn back, if I may, to Section 4, the other substantive provision of the draft. The first part of that relates to the public notice process for adopting regulations. I think the thrust of this is perhaps to make sure that the agency has a genuine dialogue with the public. The idea may be that if the draft set of regulations out to the public then significantly revises the draft, it has to take a new round of public comment. First, I should make a couple of technical points. In subsection B1 of the new section 213, the bill would require DEC to mail notice to persons who have provided comment to DEC on the proposed adoption, amendment, or repeal of a regulation. I think the intent here is probably to refer to those who have commented formally on a previously noticed draft of those regulations, but the language of the bill doesn't quite say that, and this requirement could be interpreted to invalidate a regulation just because the agency did not notify someone who had commented in some informal context at some time in the past. Also, and this is a minor concern, but the phrase mail notice should be changed to furnish notice. As we move more and more to electronic commenting, the agency receives comments by email and would want to respond, providing notice by email to people who prefer that mechanism, and the use of the word mail is usually going to be interpreted just as strictly U.S. mail. Moving on to subsection C, this is a requirement that the agency develop an explanation of why its proposed regulation is not invalid under the new standard of review that I mentioned before. This is an invitation for lawyers to compose boilerplate. It's unlikely to produce any material genuinely informative to the general public, and whatever it does produce will have to be published potentially at great cost in the Alaska Administrative Journal. Next, I'd like to comment on the core subsection here, subsection E, which requires a new round of public notice whenever the agency, in response to comment, has, quote, substantially changed the substance of the draft regulation. The first concern is that this imposes an uncertain standard. Secondly, it slows down the process considerably, whereas industry and the public in general are often impatient for regulations to become final. Third, it's costly. And fourth, it may not be an effective way to accomplish what seems to be the goal of this provision. If the goal is to make sure the agency has a meaningful dialogue with commenters, the best solution might be to require the agency to prepare and furnish to commenters a responsiveness summary, explaining why it accepted or rejected each comment. I understand some DEC divisions do this already, and it's a procedure that's been well received when it's been tried. I'd like to touch briefly on the exceptions to subsection E. The exceptions are in subparts subsection G, which straddles pages 3 and 4 of the draft. The point to be made here is that these exceptions, other than number 1, are too vague to be of any real use to the agency. We talk about reducing burdens. One person's burden is another person's benefit, and it will generally be difficult to tell if a regulation reduces burdens on society as a whole. Finally, I would like to, I should comment briefly on subsections H through K, which attempt to ensure that regulations are adopted promptly after the underlying statute is passed. These provisions suffer from similar concerns. They're vague, and even more of a problem is that the underlying assumption is that regulations will be based on a single statute that has a single effective date. Which as I mentioned previously is frequently not the case, or most commonly is not the case. These provisions will be extremely hard to apply where regulations have multiple statutes behind them, all with different effective dates, and with multiple statutory amendments that also have different effective dates. Finally, while a delay in issuing regulations can be frustrating, these provisions are perhaps a little too blunt to address that. Often the need for regulations doesn't become apparent until there's been years of experience in attempting to implement the underlying statute. It would be unfortunate to have a blanket two-year cutoff for regulations in those situations. Last of all, what I think is a technical fix. The last line of subsection J, which was line 3031 on page 4, says that the court may not hold a regulation invalid for failure to comply with, quote, this subsection, which is part but not all of the two-year limit mechanism. If this line were changed to failure to comply with subsections H through J, then the two-year limit would be something for DEC to strive for and perhaps to be embarrassed if it failed to meet the goal because we'd have to report to the legislature. But it would not be set in stone and wouldn't hold out the threat of having regulatory reforms become impossible if it later became apparent that they were needed after the two-year period had gone by. Mr. Chairman, that's all the comments I have.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate all those comments. If you have those in writing, I'd like to have those for the committees.
Information.
And next, Juno, we'll hear from Pam.
Would you like to just pull up a chair?
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Pam LeBoe, and I'm president of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. And we are very pleased to see this bill before you today and in the form that it is in. The regulatory process has been deemed by my membership to be a problem for some time, for many years. It, in fact, has been a priority of the State Chamber to fix the problems within the regulatory process for several years, one of the top priorities. Representative James, over the past, has made many efforts to make some changes and has succeeded in some, but not to the extent that I know she would like to have. The legislature has recognized for many years that there is a problem with the fact that regulations are promulgated that do not meet legislative intent. And the fact that they have tried, the legislature, the House has passed, the Senate has passed, and it's the last few years it hasn't quite gotten through, but the legislation that would get it on the ballot to change the Constitution to give them the authority, to the legislature the authority to repeal regs that don't meet legislative intent. And in fact, originally the legislature had that authority, but court decision changed that. So obviously the need has been recognized, and this bill does address some of those problems. And I'll have to say, I've never been involved in a piece of legislation that has had so many hearings and so much work. It had at least two referrals in the Senate. And in fact, in the Senate Finance Committee, I believe that there were at least a dozen hearings in before the full Senate Finance Committee. This bill was worked just unbelievably hard. Then, over the interim, we were so appreciative of the fact that we knew that it was going to take a great deal of work to get it to a state that was acceptable, because it was very encompassing, especially when it covered several agencies. And so it seemed the logical approach was to do a pilot project. Take one agency, let's try this and see how it works. And it seems that DEC was the one agency that, was a cause of many of the problems, and B was probably the easiest one to get our arms around and to try this out on. We feel that it's very reasonable that the timeline starts, and it's every regulation that's proposed from that time on, or every law that becomes effective as of July 2000. I don't see what the previous speaker, I didn't concur with his logic on how difficult this would be to put into force. So in conclusion, I would say that there has been a tremendous amount of work on this bill, and that we feel it is a very good first step in getting, in addressing some of the problems that the business community has said they've had for so many years. And the previous speaker said that this was a very novel approach, and it changed the system that had worked so well since, I believe he said, since 1959. Well, we disagree. The system has not worked well since 1959, and we are looking for a novel approach, and we feel we've got it, and we think the pilot project is the way to handle it.
Thank you, Pam. Are there questions for Ms. Lavoe?
Thank you.
Seeing none, is there anyone else here in general who would like to testify in Senate Bill 24? Seeing none, then we'll close public testimony. Dave, you've heard some of the comments from Mr. Kennedy in Anchorage. Are you prepared to respond to those now, or do you want to?
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
It is the intent to hold this bill over until Monday.
I
do want to hear from the department. I mean, it is a rework. I understand it's went through a lot of gyrations, and we've narrowed the scope. But I think it would be irresponsible and uncooperative from my part if I didn't at least give DEC an opportunity to comment on it before this committee takes any action.
Well, maybe I could use my own license here and try to summarize the arguments. First, the industry, the regulators say we're afraid this will hurt the industry, but the industry supports this. So the industry is not afraid of that. It's very big of them to be concerned, since the industry is not happy with the way they're doing it now. Then they say, well, it's going to be difficult because it won't apply to all the laws. Well, we made it not apply to all the laws to make it easy on them, so there'd only be the new ones they'd have to go through this analysis. If they're suggesting it apply to all, maybe that's a good idea too. Maybe that would solve that problem. And they say, we really don't want to have to give people notice when we change our mind about something. Well, obviously, that'd be nice, and we'd all like to be king, I guess, but that isn't the way things should work in a democracy, so they should give notice to the people, whether they really want to or not. And finally, we don't want to have to adopt regulations promptly, or even at all, if we don't want to. Seems to be the other argument. Well, we've all experienced that frustration. Here we've simply set some timelines that are basically advisory. It doesn't preclude them from moving ahead after 2 years, despite the witness's testimony, and they don't even want to have guidelines of when they adopt it. They just want total fiat, I guess, to do it willy-nilly when they want to or if they want to. That's, you know, probably great for them. It makes their job easy, but it's not good for the public or for industry. And this allegation that there's a two-year cutoff, it's very clear that it isn't a two-year cutoff. We went through great lengths to ensure that even after the 2 years, they could continue to pursue and get the regulations in place. So that's my response.
Thank you, Senator Donnelly. Other questions? Representative Croft.
Mr. Chairman, on that section on page 4 where it says may not hold a regulation invalid for a failure to comply with this subsection, meaning subsection J, but I says state agency may not take more than 2 years unless they comply with J. So I'm having trouble getting my head around all that means. I think you're right when you say that it is, that line was, makes it a guideline, and we ought to keep the guidelines in. But shouldn't it say H, I, and J? I refers to J, and J says not this subsection. How does it logically?
Well, the intent there, and I think it's clear, is if they comply with J and what J says, the two-year period, they get out from having to do it in 2 years if they do the report that's required by J. Now, if they don't do the report, then they need to do it in 2 years. And it was intended to give them a very easy out and just by filing the report.
Okay.
I guess you could suppose that they just, out of arrogance, refuse to file the report, even though they have a legal duty to do so, and then bring down on themselves the two-year limit. And if we're actually implying, or if we're anticipating their bad faith, which actually one of his arguments did, I was really astounded by the boilerplate argument. I turned around and looked at our attorneys who do administrative law for the state and said, can you believe a state attorney is arguing that we're going to actually do bad faith in complying with statutory requirements? That amazed me as an argument against a statutory requirement. It's a pretty stunning admission of their attitude. But I wouldn't mind at all if it was expanded there, because, you know, if that satisfies that concern, that's fine with me.
I'm just trying to see now. I'm not trying to change your intent. I'm not sure how it would really change the intent of that sentence. Maybe it's late in the day. I can't quite get the logical loops that all this entails, but it may not.
Is there anything else, Representative Croft?
No, just that.
Dave, one of the other comments was on page 2, where we talked about mail notices. Would you be content if we just put furnished notes? I tend to agree with
that. In fact, if you notice right below that,
and whatever else, you know, I think that's the wave of the future, and
I have no disagreement.
Bring ourselves up into that century.
In fact, we've even added publish a notice on the internet right below that, because we're trying to get that flexibility and start to work with that to save costs there too. So I have no problem with that change.
Further, Representative Murkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would you yield, Representative James?
Sir,
I had her on the list. Sorry.
Right. Well, I could have waited until after his. Hers is, and not being an attorney, I don't. And we didn't respond necessarily to that one issue of the not being retroactive, and the testifier gave a situation where after the date it might be just a minimal change to a regulation, and then his worrying about what the court would do because there'd be two different rules to follow under, which didn't seem to be a problem to me in the whole scheme of things. But could you respond just to that concern that was listed?
Mr. Chairman? If that's a real concern of the department, I'd be happy to entertain a proposal from them to clarify one way or the other. So that if there's any change, it's under the new law. I mean, that'd be simple to make. And then it wouldn't be a question. It would just write it. I think you'd do that one sentence. If a regulation is updated or changed, the new standard applies to it.
Chair Murkowski.
Thank you. And you may have had this discussion when I was out. I was held captive in Labor and Commerce. And the pilot program aspect of this whole thing, I understand that initially you started out with trying to change the world, and now you're just trying to change DEC. If it's a pilot program, are we interested in putting any parameters to that pilot program, looking at it after a period in time? When I think of pilot program, I think of a finite time period for what you're trying here. So tell me what it is that you're thinking with it now.
We had left that open, but if that's something this committee feels is important to put a time frame on it, I don't have an objection to, you know, a 4 or 5 year period. I'd like to see at least 4 or 5 years to give the industry a chance to assimilate the information and adjust to it. Give the bureaucracy a real legitimate chance to adjust also. So, you know, I wouldn't have a problem with that, but I think it's the kind of changes that obviously if we encounter there's any serious problem with it, the industry's going to be back here, you know, supporting, you know, revisions fairly quickly too.
Yeah, I guess my thought on it is that if you don't if you don't put some period of review in there, you know, essentially you've just created a new mechanism only for DEC, and everybody else is kind of off on your own unless you decide next year to take on Commerce or whoever it is. But just something to think about. I don't have any specific recommendations in that regard yet, and I don't know what the discussion was about it.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a problem with putting a sunset on it. I'm willing to give it a try. I feel really positive about these changes, unlike some folks in the bureaucracy, obviously. I'm willing to give them a try. I'm excited to see what would happen, you know. And actually, I'm very optimistic that once it got into place, that people would want the changes in other parts of the bureaucracy also. But, you know, I'm open to a sunset period, too.
Okay. And Dave, that was precisely the reason why I asked the question, because if we decided, and you weren't here at that point in time, but if, in fact, we put a sunset on it, say 4 or 5 years, and it's going to take at least 2 years to get these regulations out, so if you had 4 years, you're really looking at only 2 years, you know, of real actual review. But if you put that sunset out and the program is working, then it will force us, or force whoever's in this body, to come back and add the rest of the other agencies or departments or however more of an expansion you want to go to. And if it's not working, then we don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
So that was the whole gist of why that sunset, I thought, was somewhat important. Is there further questions for the sponsor?
Just one more.
Sam Croft.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the differing burden of proof sections, that provision on significant benefits to public resources has been part of the Forest Practices Act for a while, since 90.
Yeah, are you talking about page 2, lines like 8 through 10 there?
Yeah.
That is the same part, right? I think that is the part that's in there.
That
was a suggestion that came out of the industry group, working group this summer.
It would be a court that would make the determination significant public benefits, which seemed odd to me at first, but I wonder if there's any history, I think C. Alaska said something about that, any history of any court case on that issue under the Forest Practices?
I'm not positive, and the timber people aren't here now. Are they right there?
I think if you repeat the question, I'm Rick Harris.
Okay, this was your stuff.
Sorry.
And can you come forward and so the mic can pick you up?
I'm not a timber person.
Eric, can you direct your question?
Yeah, has there been any case law on the yielding significant benefits to public resources under the Forest Practices Act?
No, we've since 1990 we've revised the.
If you would, excuse me, state your name.
I'm sorry, Rick Harris. I'm a senior vice president for C. Alaska Corporation, Natural Resources. Under the provision of the Forest Practices, we have gone through and done one additional revision to the Forest Practices Act, which was passed by this legislature, I believe, 1 or 2 years ago. And this guideline and standard actually helped us as we went through and determined what should be the changes to the Act. You know, what was the science and what was the technical data that was available to us to support additional buffer standards on riparian and non-anadromous streams. And this standard actually became kind of a guiding principle that we used as we went forward in revising that. I'll mention that amendment to the Act passed unanimously by both houses of the Alaska legislature, unamended. We were able to work that process outside the legislative process, but with all the interest groups. And it became, as they say, a very good guideline for us to work from. And it was a test as we went back and said, does this change make sense? And how does it, you know, work against this standard? And out of that, then we were able to all reach agreements. And to the extent that the environmental community, the fishing community, all came in support of that bill. So we haven't had to test it in court, but it has been a useful guideline for us as we've gone forward.
It seems like with something as carefully negotiated as that, that that might explain why there hasn't been any litigation of it. It's an unusual standard for a court to find that this fits the regulation, but the court itself is going to measure the significance of the benefits to the public. That's what I was wondering, on what standard they would use. But if it hasn't been done.
And I just might inject, that was one of the reasons we worked so hard on the burden of proof section, because to give the court more guidance in how they interpret that, and to say that if somebody wants to overturn based on that standard, they're going to have to bring forward the evidence to convince the court that, you know, they've got the burden to bring that forward.
But a lower burden, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, a lower burden than they would have saying it doesn't meet the statutory intent. Interesting.
Further questions?
No, thank you.
Okay, then we will take all the information that we have heard today, try to incorporate many of the ideas. The sponsor has agreed to begin with. And we'll bring the bill back up next week. Maybe Wednesday. I don't intend on having 12 hearings on this.
Mr. Chair, you said we're having somebody from DEC. Did we have comments from them today?
There's no one here from DEC today. They were here earlier. They were here last week when we had the bill scheduled and pulled it. So it's only, I think, responsible to let them at least testify. Mm-hmm. So with that, we will adjourn. Thank you all.